I moved to Vermont a couple years ago. It's a state that usually lands in the top five of best states for craft beer. Now, don't get me wrong, they do have really good beer, but honestly, the advertising, it's super boring. Also in Vermont, we're super proud of being super eco-conscious, top five level again, if not number one in the country. But the fact that the next idea wasn't made here is amazing to me. Okay, truthfully, it isn't a total surprise, but anyway, but the fact that the next idea was made at all, well, that's the most astonishing part. Welcome to episode 8, the making of Brewtrolium, biofuel made from beer. Yeah, you heard me right. Brewtrolium. Brewtrolium.
Welcome to How to Kill a Lion, the braingasms, anxiety, and creative chaos behind the biggest ideas in advertising, and how they won a big, shiny con lion.
I think it's pronounced can.
Okay.
Like can of whoop ass or soup or something.
Mm-mm. And how they won a big, shiny cans lion.
Mm-mm-mm. Nope. No S. Can.
But really? Are you sure?
Well, no one's really sure, but some awesome old French dude in a tiny Speedo called it that. And he was born there, so that's what we're going with.
All right, got it. Punching in. And how they won a giant fucking can lion.
Nailed it!
Get on the roof and hold on tight.
Why don't you try reading the rules, Shankopotamus?
It's tie, Dad.
Don't have a grandson with a dog collar.
This is How to Kill a Lion with Jordan Buntaine.
Joining me today is Simon Vickers, who is currently the executive creative director at Colenso BBDO, which is in Auckland, New Zealand. Now, back in 2016, he and, I may screw this up, guys, I apologize, Andre Salowitz, Matt Lawson, and Brett Culliver, did I get it? They won every award imaginable for their Brewtrolium campaign for DB Export, which is a brand under DB Breweries, which is owned by Heineken. So specifically, though, in 2016, they won a titanium at Cannes, and they also took home the Outdoor Grand Prix. And of course, with that comes a bucket or armfuls or bagfuls of golds in almost every category. Now, let's go back in time a little bit. Back to when I was a strapping young 20-year-old just coming out of ad school, and my dream was to work as a copywriter on a beer brand. Any beer brand. In beer advertising, you could do anything. I loved it. Now, I was in Canada, and of course, we got most U.S. advertising, too. But my favorite campaigns were, you know, everyone probably knows Bud Light, Real Men of Genius. But in Canada, we also had Anything Can Happen Out of the Blue. We also had, I think, almost a country-defining campaign called I Am Canadian from Molson. I mean, you could do anything in a beer commercial, and most advertisers did. It was, and I'd say even more so today, it's really hard to do an idea that stands out in the beer category. And recently, I thought everything had been done. Until I saw this.
No challenge poses a greater threat to our future and future generations than a changing climate. And that's what brings us here today.
In 2015, we asked the men of New Zealand to unite against climate change, to come together to make a difference, to commit themselves to the ultimate cause, to save the world by drinking beer. Introducing Brewtrolium, a biofuel made from the yeast left over after we finish brewing DB Export. Scientifically formulated to reduce carbon emissions by 8%. To save the entire world, we needed men to drink DB Export. Lots of DB Export. And they did.
Where are you going?
To save the world.
All over the country, men answered the planet's cry for help. And in doing so, helped to create over 300,000 litres of DB Export Brewtrolium. Enough to open our own station and to supply 60 Gull service stations around the country. But we knew there was more we could do. So we created DB Export 0.0% Citrus, a zero alcohol beer so that everyone could help.
I will help.
I will.
I will help too.
As the effects of global warming began to reverse, the rest of the world began to take notice.
Brutroleum.
Brutroleum.
Y lo han llamado Brutroleum.
Brutroleum. Bitroleum.
Suddenly, every sip made a difference. Every party was for the planet. In a beer market declining, sales of DB Export increased by an unprecedented 9%, making DB Export the fastest growing beer brand in the country. So, did we really save the entire world? Well, are you watching this from Earth? You're welcome.
So here are some things you don't know, and this is what Simon and I get into. The idea was essentially 5 years in the making. So we discuss some of the other ideas that they had created for a local cider brand, which then gave the client confidence to start chasing this crazy beer biofuel idea. Now, also one crazy thing is that they are still producing Brutroleum. This is not a one-and-done TV commercial. It is a big-ass idea. And then again, most importantly, we dig into Simon's creative process and discuss the way that he operates and how he comes up with ideas. And I guess if you've listened to a few of my podcasts already, I think you're starting to see patterns. One of them, Simon is also originally a copywriter, and I had a lot of fun hanging out with him. And I can't wait to crack a beer with him in can and save the world at some non-pandemic point. But anyway, let's get going. This is Brutroleum. The link to the case study is in the podcast description, but the real deal starts now. This is Simon Vickers, ECD Colenso, BBDO, New Zealand. All right, well, I'm gonna start out properly here. Let's just do this correctly here. Hold on, ready? Here we go. Okay, there we go. I'm just gonna crack a beer because we're
going to crack a beer. Forgive me, it's 10 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I mean, if you're not gonna dedicate yourself, I don't know.
It is a Friday. Yeah,
but I'm gonna crack a beer and save the world. So I'm super excited about that. Man, I mean, why don't we just dive right in? You know, like. What's funny about Brutroleum? So I think if you were in any other year, you would have won the Grand Prix of Titanium, because the year that you were in 2016, there were so many pieces of great work. There were, like, you were up against, that was the year that Opt Out Side won, right? And what else was in there? Field Trip to Mars. McWhopper. One of my favorites was the Pinterest. The Pinterest one. What was it called again? I'm trying to remember. I'm just blanking. It was Pinterest Yard Sale.
Oh, Yard Sale. Yard Sale was in there.
That was genius. There was the Van Gogh B&B. And I remember even the Xbox, I think it was McCann, did an Xbox survival billboard.
Yeah, like, those survival billboard guys, that we would do the award circuit once Brutroleum kind of got on its run, and we would always see those guys at Clio's or whatever, and it was always kind of like, Brutroleum guys.
I know.
Because survival billboard was, leading up to the festival was the one, and outdoor, everyone was kind of big upping it, and it was so good. So yeah, it was a massive year.
Oh yeah, that's the thing. So if you were like, I mean, you can have one of some great creative, and then all of a sudden you go in and one just, it's going to be like, oh. For me, I remember it was, of course, now I'm blanking again. It was, I can see it in my head.
The year you really didn't want to enter Cannes was Dumb Ways to Die. Dumb Ways to Die just kind of absolutely, it won a print on the very first day.
Exactly.
And every other day it turned up. And, I remember, I can't recall exactly what ads that were in those categories, but amazing campaigns that just, all of them just got nudged down to gold that any other year would have been Grand Prix.
I know. And, the earworm, you're done. There's no way. You're getting out of that. Oh yeah, man. But I mean, with like Brutroleum, I mean, that was, I remember seeing that and just thinking to myself, oh yeah, there was also the Swedish number was that year too.
The Swedish number was that year as well.
I was at Gray when that was, when that was coming out of, I think it was obviously Sweden, but there was so much competition that year. So to win that, and I've talked to Lee Einhorn earlier too on Opt Outside and how that all came about. So to hear also the things that went on in that actual judging room for Titanium was pretty wild. Knowing what was going to win, but then some person stood up and said, no, you can't do this because the client is evil or whatever it was, it was just like hearing it was one of the more, heated rooms for who was going to win that year. So
it definitely was a stacked festival, and I remember, like, New Zealand, McWhopper came out of Waianae, New Zealand, and Brutroleum, right. And McWhopper picked up two Grand Prix, and we got a Grand Prix in the Titanium. It was just this surreal year in New Zealand. You know, the that both those campaigns went as high as they did. It was it was a massive party.
Yeah, for sure. Massive party. That's great. That's really good. Well, let's dive into it. You know, like, I mean, it's a campaign I'll never forget. Of course, the immediate thing was like. Like, I guess the first, like, who came, like, where did, who said, hey, we're going to turn beer into petroleum and then we're going to save the world? Like, who did the science? Did they come to you? Did you guys think you could change the brand? Like, tell me how that all came about, like, in the beginning. And then I want to go into, like, the brief itself. So,
yeah, the Brutroleum wasn't one of those ideas that you just kind of onto paper, Brutroleum. Like, it was this long, long process of failure and incremental steps towards the right answer. You know, we got it wrong so many times before we got it right. And, like, real, you know, a lot of credit to Andy Blood, who is the creative director on the project, you know, just constant rejection, but always in an inspiring way, you know, to continue that kind of search. So it was this kind of crazy, crazy process, but it did start, and it was a complex project, easily the most complex project I've ever done. But the starting point was really kind of simple and clear in the brief, just the problem that just guys weren't drinking beer anymore. Mainstream beer was in this massive decline, and just guys weren't drinking beer anymore. So it was a mad project, crazy complex execution, but the starting point was just so clear.
You know why I'm laughing is, like, okay, just, and you think back to yourself when you were, like, that young, you know, 20-year-old coming out of, like, you know, like a portfolio school, like, I'd love to get a job in advertising when I'm done here. And imagine if I get to work on a beer account.
Like, yeah,
for me, that was exciting. That was the one you wanted to be on, right? But so to end up getting a brief that says, like, you got to get guys to drink more beer, and that's your brief and your starting point, I find just hilarious.
But, man, once you start, I mean, it is a poison chalice, and it's almost it's fool's gold in a way, right?
Yeah. Beer,
because from the outside, you look at it and you go, yes, give me that thing over an insurance brand. But, you know, the best work that we do talks about a product benefit or is based on a product truth,
yeah.
And you can't talk about. You can't talk about the benefit of alcohol. You know, you can't.
No.
There are so many kind of things that we can't do. And so once you actually get working on beer, you realize. And also the other thing is there's just been so much great work done on beer.
Yeah.
That, you know, when you compare that to insurance, which you're like, but man.
I would argue actually here in the U.S., insurance is actually the most creative stuff right now.
You're right. Geico, you know, like, yeah, there's different, right?
Progressive and Farmers, they're all doing really great. But the beer stuff, yeah. And exactly, the lawyers, well, let's be honest, you guys were able to say drink more beer and save the world. So the lawyers were pretty chill on you, you know.
Yeah.
That's a claim.
Jordan, hyperbole. If I'm in the court of law, it's we get away with it with a hyperbole. Apparently.
All right. So let me just get this straight. So you just had a brief that said, like, guys aren't drinking beer. We want to, you know, up at 5-10%, whatever our metrics are. And then were you guys trying to find, like, a brand truth for DB Export, or did they come to you, or how were you spitballing ideas? Like, did you bring it to them saying this is the brand that you could be, or did they come to you and saying, you know, this is something we could think about? Like, how'd that come about?
Well, yeah, a couple of things, because Brutroleum also, like, it was such a mad campaign in the way that it was structured and how, you know, the non-traditional elements that it had in it. But, you know, we didn't just go from print ads to Brutroleum. You know, it was a journey over about 5 years with the export. You know, we did a campaign for their cider, apple cider brand. All the other ciders used concentrated fruit juice. They used real fruit. How could we prove it? So we added a step on the production line where we added twigs and leaves from their orchard, from their apple orchards, into the boxes. And there was this, and then we just put them out into the world, and there was this product recall, and, you know, we had to apologize for the twigs, but that's just part of the process when you make stuff with real fruit. And, you know, they sold out a cider and it won a can, and, you know, that was like the first step of Brutroleum, like 5 years before. And, you know, they, you know, the business results around a campaign or an idea that that didn't just use broadcast, that used different kind of mechanisms. You know, they had seen the value kind of to the business.
And it came from such a thing. So the idea, like I still remember, you know, it doesn't matter how many, you know, Grand Prix of Titaniums that, you know, Rob Riley wins. I mean, he says that the best thing he ever did was make apple fries for Burger King. So, you know, it's when you actually do something to the product that really changes it too. Like that's just an ultimate truth at the end of the day. So I think being down on the floor too, that reminds me of that old, it was one of the, you know, you're a copywriter and I'm a copywriter. So when you find those little tiny nuggets within something, it's just like, that's, you know, that's the moment when you hear it and you see it and you start sort of creating around it, which I remember was a, I think it was an Ogilvy ad. And back in like the 60s, and it was the clock on the Rolls Royce. There's a guy who makes the clock quieter on the Rolls Royce. That's how you know that there was something wrong with this Rolls Royce. The clock was too loud, you know? And so it was only found because he was walking. Exactly. He was on the line, right? And he was walking by and he was just talking. The copywriter was talking to people and he says, "Hey, man, what do you do?" He says, "Well, I work on the clock." He's like, well, what do you do with a clock? Well, it's too loud. I'm like, what do you mean it's too loud? Like, it just shows you when you're saying to yourself, well, this car is about detail and luxury. Like, that just screamed it when you found it. So when you're on the line there, actually dropping twigs and learning all about all that stuff and figuring all that out, like, that's the gold.
Yeah, the, you know, that I don't know which agency says it or whose mantra it is, but the truth well told. I don't know who that can be attributed to, but yeah, yeah, that's something I believe in. Just
I think that's McCann. So much.
Is it McCann? Yeah, I mean,
I think so.
Those McCann guys just do so well. But the, you know, I love it so much, that truth well told. You know, there's that comedian scenario. You know, when the comedian says something that everyone in the audience is thinking, but they've never said out loud.
Yeah,
and you know, it doesn't need to be offensive. You know, but it can just be your thought that you've never really voiced. And yeah, that was one of those things, you know, the truth was that they used real fruit and yeah, and off you go.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. So, okay. So at what point do you like, where does like, oh, we could all this crap over here, we could turn into fuel. Like,
yeah,
it's a leap from dropping twigs into a box to say like, yeah, you know, was, go. I love this idea.
So twigs was more of a kind of love and trust. So that was the first step in kind of embracing the non-traditional kind of executions.
Yeah.
And then so, but back to Brutroleum, you know, that problem of just guys weren't drinking beer and it was, our target market was guys, you know, that was where 90% of the volume was. So we could just kind of go head on at guys. And, but the strategy crew at Colenso, you know, have always just taken the complicated and made it simple. I love strategists and they're so good. And they just kind of said, our job is to try and find a way to help guys justify going for a beer. You know, like they were working longer hours. And then, you know, at the end of a 70-hour week, you know, they had a choice with either hanging out with their buddies at the pub or going home and seeing their wife and kid. Like they, you know, they had time pressure. There was health, like beer had kind of become unhealthy, or the perception of being unhealthy, and mainstream kind of awareness of health was there. And then also like beer just totally lacked sophistication from, and it was all our fault, like 3 decades of like goofy guys and ads like slapping ass and trying to score foreign exchange students, you know, like it was all our own doing, you know, and it was not sophisticated, and guys just didn't feel like they had the permission to go for a beer anymore. Society just was like, don't think that's a good idea.
Right. That makes sense too. Yeah, exactly. That's good. So it almost like it, so it needed, you know, I needed that sort of social responsibility layer, but where does, you know, that's the, to chase that would be hard. You don't want to manufacture it, like just sticking on, like, we're going to save water, you know, or something like that, because it's attached to beer in some way. So if you, but then you went and actually turned the byproduct into fuel, so that we can run cars better. Like who did the, like who came, was it like one of the engineers inside who said this is a possibility, and then, or did just, no, how did that come up?
It really came up by like stepping our way towards that answer. Cause we started, there were 2 teams on it. Andre Selovich, Matty Lawson, and Brett Colliver and myself. And we were working together on it. And we eventually got to this point where, we figured out that we need to give beer a higher purpose. So we started out with kind of excuse generators, like under every cap, you know, there might be an excuse why you're, you know, that kind of thinking, or babysitting currency. I think that was one of the other ideas, that you could use the cap as a babysitting currency. So lots of really bad ideas.
Exactly.
But then we got this like, collectively got to this thought that if we could give beer a higher purpose, then suddenly it would be more permissible to go for a beer. And I think, like, we had done rounds and rounds of creative presentations to the DB crew. And I think we did two rounds of this higher purpose kind of thought. And then Andre was just on, looking online, and he found out that through the brewing process, there's a heap of leftover yeast. So yeast multiplies continuously in the brewing process. So at the end of it, you know, they've got a stack of it, and they dump it or sell it to Marmite or something like that. But in that yeast, there's still residual ethanol, and that ethanol could be extracted and turned into a biofuel. And so, you know, they wrote down Beertrolium, and we were with Andy Blood, and we're talking about ideas, and Beertrolium came up, and it was just like, oh my God, this is, you know, that electricity. It was just like, whoa, let's go. This is incredible. And this is
impossible. You know, we have to make
it. Yeah, totally. This is going to ruin some people's lives. But it's incredible. And it's interesting. Like, it's straight away interesting, you know, audacious. And then, you know, like, we were all of us are pretty energetic guys. Like, Brady's pretty cool, but he's in his own way, he's energetic. And Andy Blood, and we were buzzing. But then it wasn't until a couple of days later when we wrote the line, "Drink DB Export, save the entire world," when everything just kind of clicked, and it was like the last piece of the puzzle. And we're like, oh yeah, this is good. Now this is good.
This is so funny. Like, well, one thing what's great about that too is, like, obviously you dove into the research of it, right? Like, you're saying, okay, it's a great idea, but Ken, do you think we actually can do it? And for all you young interns out there, here's a little trick, is that you always talk about piloting the project somewhere first before you start talking about scale or anything like that. That always makes a client feel much happier and excited. Like, if you're on a global brand, like, you know, do something in Belarus first. Don't say, you know, we're going to blanket the US with, nope, it's a bad way to start any slide.
Yeah, but I mean, the first question from our amazing DB Export client was like, I love it, can we do it? And, you know,
right. And you have to have an answer. Yeah.
Yeah, to have an answer. And you know, like, we'll talk about who was fundamental to this project, but, you know, the production crew at Colenso were just like, you know, when you have an idea and you go to another creative team and you tell them and they go, oh yeah, that's really good. And, you know, that make, you know, that feeds your excitement.
Right.
And the worst thing in an agency is when you go to another department and you go, what about this? And they go, and then the love and enthusiasm starts to wane, and but we went to production, and production were just like, That sounds incredible.
That's great. Well, thanks too. When you have done the work too, right? Like, the actual research, you've thought about it a bit. You've said, you know, here's how we kind of roll it out a bit, even if it's just like sticks and stones or whatever. But sure, I always like to say to people, like, oh, you did the math. Right. Because, like, no one wants to do the math at the end of the day. Like, I did an ad for a smart car one time, and I actually did the math to see how much would it take to go and crush this sort of safety cell that's around this car. No one had done it. Right. But I was just like, well, let's see, because, of course, I want to see how many clowns I can fit into an SUV and then try and smash this thing. Right. Like, something stupid off the back end. There's no, you know, it's not because I actually care about the math, because I want to do something stupid to it. And then, but once you do that, and then there's usually an engineer in the room when you're presenting these things too, who's like, oh my God, we could do that. And then the momentum just starts to build, you know?
Yeah. When you work with people who are hardwired, say yes, you know, that's so important. Mm-hmm. And the production crew at Colenso were, you know, to say yes first, and then really figure out, you know, if it's a no, as opposed to no first.
Yeah.
And the momentum of the whole kind of agency starts to kind of stutter. So yeah, Scotty Chapman was our main production guy, and yeah, he's just this MacGyver who is hardwired to say yes, and who, like, is a bit of a sociopath and just likes to ruin his life. You know, this was just 100% commitment. But yeah, that excitement that was when it was met with excitement at production, you know, that was such an important stage to just keep a roll on.
That's great. That's really good. Yeah. Wow. I mean, It's just funny. I keep going, I keep picturing myself as like, you know, the ad student kid, like one day being able to work on a beer account and then to have sort of this, high, you know, to give beer higher purpose basically was where you were headed. There's just, you know, I think it's just so amazing. Like, okay, so let me ask the question then. So you wrote down Beer Trolium and maybe it was like obviously more sort of pie in the sky thinking, but like from where you that idea was set down and you all guys just started, yeah, buzzing for a couple of days to like when you're at Cannes and the thing is finished, like did it change dramatically between sort of this napkin and the corkboard, or was it fairly tight at the end of the day?
The idea remained exactly the same, but the ambition of how we brought it to life like changed every day, you know, nice. In the lead up to Cannes. And it was this hopes and dreams roller coaster that we hopped on for a year. And you know, you come in one day and it was dead. And then the next day it was back alive. And, you know, it was torture, really. When I look back on it, it was torture. But the ambition or the audacity of how we brought it to life changed so many times throughout the process. You know, there were problem after problem. No one had done it before. You know, so there was no commercial infrastructure to extract the ethanol out of the leftover yeast. And so we thought about maybe we ship it overseas to get it extracted, then bring it back. And we thought that would maybe contradict the environmental kind of
footprint,
environmental ambition. Yeah. And eventually Scotty figured out that the whiskey process, they had the infrastructure. So whiskey companies had the infrastructure to potentially extract this ethanol for us. Mm. And no whiskey company would touch the idea. And then we eventually found this kind of bootleg whiskey company, an hour and a half out of, and you know,
these guys overalls, he's playing some Leonard Skinner. Yeah. He's like, I got you.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And they were just brilliant problem solvers, and which was good because we had heaps of problems, you know, and they weren't this kind of commercial entity that was process driven. They were just solution driven, and they were just amazing partners. And they got in, took our waste and did a sample, and extracted the ethanol. It was 98% pure. We needed 100% pure. So we had another problem, but you know, that they overcame that. And so they were able to extract it, and that was an amazing kind of moment for us. But then it was, you know, we were a bunch of creative goofballs, and we'd create this highly explosive kind of material, and you know, we just didn't really know what we were doing. So there was a whole heap of partners that we had to bring in order to transport it safely, and so. Once, I mean, that was definitely easily 6 months. And then it was about how do we execute it? And we were going to import 10 cars from South America that just ran on ethanol, and they were going to be taxis for drinkers. You know, that was one way of doing it. And the another way was giving fuel vouchers out to drinkers. And it just felt small. And then we got the idea to do a station. So we'd do one station and we'd mix it with petroleum. So it'd be an ethanol petroleum mix. And yeah, then we had the idea to do the station and then things just kind of snowballed. And yeah, it was just a lot of those problems that we had before, timelines and things like that, actually turned out to our advantage. You know, the marketing budget rolled over for another year, so we got more money. Mm-hmm. Heineken sustainability kind of pot that was out there that we knew nothing about, they had money dedicated to that pot, so we got that. And then the fuel partner that we worked with, Gull, had a marketing budget. And so, yeah, suddenly all those problems, you know, just through perseverance went away, and it just got bigger and bigger.
That's nice. I love that too. I love that as partners came on, they kind of had a stake in it and would add in their own marketing budget. You know, that's, yeah, I can see how that snowballs it too. I mean, that kind of reminds me a bit of like, I guess that was more once the campaign come out. I was thinking opt outside, you know, like everyone else started doing closing on whatchamacallit, on the
Black
big
Friday.
Day. Yeah, Black. Thank you, Black Friday. My brain, I got COVID brain. I've been inside way too much, you know. everyone closed on Black Friday. So this is rolling thunder, you know, but it sounds like sort of almost internally as you're making it, like people are going, well, we can help too in this way. Why don't we, you know, that's something.
Yeah. It was massive momentum, which only came through just slog. But I remember our CEO, Nick Garrett, walking in. We were talking about how we're going to roll out petroleum, and we got to the petrol station idea, and he was like, I don't want to do a petrol station. Dallas had just done a petrol station, I think the year before at Cannes.
And that was us. That was Grey New York at the time.
Oh, was it? Yeah. So he looked at that, and he's like, don't do that. That's already been done. And we thought, well, how are we going to get around this? And he said, you know, and also he made such a good point. He's like, you know, this is your piece of communications. You know, get as many people to see it as possible. So then by the end of that week, you know, we had 67 stations around the country, you know, through our petrol partner. And so it became less about that one station and more about this distribution of this product. And we had a ginormous tanker that, or three tankers that traveled the country kind of taking the petroleum around. So he was, yeah, that moment was pretty important that the size of the idea, the size of the execution warranted the kind of size of the idea.
Absolutely. And just for the record, when I say us, I mean Grey New York. That was Lisa and Derek who created that. It was for Dallas. That was good. I was about to bring it up, but obviously it was on your guys' radar, which is amazing. Do they still have stations? Like, is this campaign like still alive? Are they still making, you know, the ethanol?
Yeah, so Brutroleum still is going, is still being distributed and pumped.
That's awesome.
Which is great. I mean, the origins of Brutroleum in a way was like we were just so pissed off about. I mean, that's where the line "Drink DB Export Saved the Entire World" came from, because like we were just pissed off with greenwashing from brands. You know, every brand was saving the world, but no one really was. You know, 1 cent from every burger was going towards planting trees, you know, while they cleared the Amazon to feed the cow and your burger, you know, like it was all just bullshit. Insincerity and obvious corporate manipulation, you know, of consumers. And we just wanted to make our commercial agenda like comically transparent, you know, empty this thing and you'll save the world.
That's right. And exactly. The wink is there, and it's just like this is for fun, and we're, you know, exactly. I think it's just a great excuse too to have another beer. Let's be honest. That's okay. So coming from, I grew up in Canada, so much like, you know, New Zealand, we have the same sort of, I think, dominions, are we, of the British Empire, whatever it is. But I don't know if, like, I know when I came to the U.S., the lawyers got a lot more lax on me. So like the immediate thing when I was watching the case study again, went back to my days of being in Canada. I was like, oh, you know what? Like, I know if I was to come up with this idea back in Canada, like some lawyer would come in and say, you can't say like drink more beer and save the world and also have a car in there, because, you know, you're insinuating that if you drink more beer and then you drive, you're doing a good thing. Like, did some lawyer come in and say that, or am I just making stuff up at this point?
Do you know what? That was our biggest worry going into it. We were like, we're making a fuel going into a car, and you can't drink and associate drinking with cars. And nobody brought it up. And so we just didn't talk about it. We just kept on trucking on, just waiting for that phone call for someone to go. I mean, maybe the account service crew just shielded us from all that, but it was a massive concern that never came up.
Oh, yeah, because again, for all the interns who will be going into advertising and listen to this podcast, you're going to love lawyers and you're going to hate lawyers. And it depends where you are and what you're working on, because beer is a nightmare. Actually, I found sometimes in the beer marketing, you can have fun with what you can't do. I mean, that's what you did a little bit, right? I mean, it's like the minute that you're given some handcuffs, you're like, how do I make these handcuffs completely transparent and just dick with it?
You see so much good work that just kind of understands the restrictions that it's under and you know, finds clever ways to not defy it, but, you know, work around it. You know, I always think of Geico Unskippable as like just such a, they just understood that they had pre-roll ads, you know, they were just from the get-go. And, you know, the problem with the pre-roll is it only lasts 6 seconds, and then they went and found a great solution.
Yeah, exactly.
I always love seeing work like that.
Well, there's an understanding. Like, there's an understanding between you and the viewer. Like, they know they have to watch it, and you know that they're going to watch it. So if you give them a little wink, you know, like, we know it's an ad. All right, but you know, we're here together. Let's just have some fun. You know, that seems to be okay at the end of the day. You know, except of course there's a fine line of going like too meta. You know, like you're way too in deep, yeah. And you've made a joke that only you guys internally are laughing at, but then the average viewer doesn't. You know, it's like that. Just sails over their head.
That Geico thing is just such a good example of the truth well told again. You know, like understanding what people's thought process is when they're watching this thing.
For sure.
Yeah, I love that.
That's good. Now you said that like everyone, there was like tons of buzz, and obviously everyone was vibing on it. Production was vibing on it. You guys were good. Was there anybody like internally who was, because this is one thing I noticed a lot, that when you have a crazy idea that's like, you know, I mean, you are reaching for this idea because so many people have to get involved. And like, did someone say that's crazy, that's stupid, and just like ruin your momentum at all? Or was it pretty much just easy sailing, you know, the whole way?
I definitely wouldn't say it was easy sailing, but everyone wanted to make it. That was, I think, the an important part of it. You know, from our PR partners to our media agency, who were just amazing, and out at DB or the Heineken crew. You know, Heineken have this system where they send their people from Amsterdam, and they place them in far kind of corners of the world for a couple of years, and we had a Dutch woman come down called Maud, and you know, she was only there for 2 years, and she wanted to leave and you know, make a mark. And underneath her was Sean and Tony, who were just as ambitious. So yeah, that everyone who was involved wanted to see it succeed, as opposed right. to you know, wither and die.
I remember because I've had ideas that I think it's different agencies too. I mean, that's the culture that you create, you know, like I was at one agency, I remember, where there was just a lot of, you know, it was almost like, I wouldn't say that, it was just almost like people had never made that kind of work before. They didn't pay attention to award shows to see what work was great and what other people were doing. And then at the same time too, I think there was just this sort of fear of, I may have to work harder. You know, where if you're at a place, obviously, like you guys had that, you know, that energy in house. And then you also had, you know, like for me, I know that Crispin was that way, you know, like Gray was definitely that way when I was there. And it was just had this like, you know, we can do better, you know, at all times. And so you were just willing to always reach for the crazy idea. And then you'd look at each other and say, like, well, is this possible? And then someone would go, nope, but we're going to figure it out. And you just had each other's backs. So it's just this sort of energy, you know, that happens in a place like that, I think.
Oh yeah, 100%. And you can see it from outside. I feel like when I look at the CPB work, you know, you can see that, you know, a creative department doesn't make that work. An agency makes that work.
Yeah.
And it's the same with Colenso. The, you know, that mantra, there's a mantra at Colenso, which is don't make ads, make interesting. You know, the clients who are with us, the marketing teams that are with us, you know, have signed up and subscribed to that way of thinking. So half the sell is already done in the room, you know, because they value creativity but that doesn't happen at every agency. So you start from scratch, and you know, mm-hmm. that is really hard. So when you see really killer work come out of places that aren't, you know, aren't in this kind of cadence of making that work, I really admire the people and the trust from the clients to make that work.
One big thing too, I think, is like you guys had, I mean, you had an idea, right? It wasn't obviously, because you know the places that you work at where like someone says, okay, so I've got this idea. Okay, so we open on, like, they don't even start with like, okay, it's a TV ad. It's like, well, this is how we do ads. Okay, so you open on, like, don't start with the TV. Like, that's mistake number one. If you're starting with, okay, here's the TV ad, it's like, I'm not sure you have an idea yet. Like, it needs to be almost just media agnostic, and it's a solution to an answer, you know, or a problem or whatever it is. And it's like, I always found that was the thing. Like, you know, anytime someone comes to me and says, I've got this great idea and it's a television spot, I'm just like, I'm not sure you do yet, you know, unless there's like, we go make something, as you say, make something interesting. And then we tell everyone about it, you know, and how you do that. It's a different way.
The elevator pitch of an idea is, yeah, is is the test. Like when great agencies keep doing good work, you can just tell that they've honed that kind of that ruthless way of judging ideas. And yeah. I saw something out of Grey New York last week that a kid unboxes his parents' handgun. Saw that on LinkedIn, and I hadn't even watched the video yet, but I loved it straight away. You know, like that's the elevator pitch idea that your CCO is walking to their car, and you know, can I tell you something? You got 20 seconds, and 20 seconds. I love that idea.
Unboxed handgun. So,
it's just so good.
I was really happy to see that too, because we did a lot of gun work. You know, I did a lot of gun work, and then guys, Marco and Joao, who worked at Gray afterwards, did gun shop the year prior. And then the gun work continued throughout, which is really good. So they've been sort of sticking to their guns, shall I say, you know, give or take, you know, just sort of really, really pounding away at that one, which is good. But yeah, I mean,
yeah, Generation Lockdown is another just amazing piece of work.
Yeah.
And the book that stopped the bullet, and really, really powerful. But again, all those things can be, 20 seconds as your CCO walks to their car. Yeah, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, and then that's the best part is once you tell it to them, then you got to walk away because the rest of that elevator ride or that drive home or wherever it is they're going, it's like all of a sudden you just see the fruit falling from the trees. Like you're like, oh, it works in out of home, it works in TV, it works in video, it works in skippables, it works in, whatever you want it to be. It's like, okay, I see it. Simple. It's like go ahead.
Yeah, that is, I think, when the room lights up, when everyone can instantly see that you've found that killer truth, but then also how it could come to life just so quickly in a whole bunch of ways. Brutrolium, to be fair, wasn't one of those, that would have been a long walk to the car to explain that one to a CCO. Let me tell you about the problem and then I love those ideas that what are about, just.
Yeah, yours though. I mean, it turns into so many things. I mean, you guys turned it into the activation, right? And then you had all these great pieces of film with it. And I mean, like you didn't just. I mean, you obviously won the Grand Prix for it was outdoor, right? And of course the titanium.
Yeah.
But like, it had all those other pieces to it too. Like, were there any pieces that say you had too that were like even little tchotchkes or whatever that just didn't get made that you were like, oh.
Yeah, it's when you're in the process, you think. It's interesting to retrospectively look back on it and go, oh, this campaign can't live without this piece. And then often it can, the main idea really was that this Brutrolium that we created was a media channel, at all 67 stations on the pumps, at the handles, at the things, they were all branded. And, that was really like this disruptor of a media channel. And then, there were PR partnerships that got us kind of reach way outside paid kind of channels. So there was a documentary that we made and that we never put out, which was about 5 minutes long, and it was called The Convenient Truth. And it was all about it was a piss take of, the world is in peril. We had polar bears walking across ice, and it talked about how these brown bears are now ghosts because they've died. And it was all just, it was all stupidity. And, Brutrolium it didn't need that, and we made it, but we never put it out there.
That's good. Have there been like, I know with a lot of these, I mean, yours is pretty involved. I mean, you had scientists working on some of this stuff here. So maybe, I know a lot of ads sometimes, or the winners, especially in the titanium category, they haven't been done before, so they're kind of first of class of like, no one's turned their stuff into ethanol before, right? So has there been anybody, have you noticed afterwards, who have kind of went and done that, like sort of like a copycat approach after Brutrolium?
There was more and more, I think I started noticing more and more, here's a byproduct of our production process, let's turn it into something, or here's what we do with old t-shirts once they've been used or whatever. Yeah. I think I started noticing more and more that kind of work, which is great and totally needed in the world. But no one has ever asked, no client has ever asked like, oh, give me a Brutrolium. Because they all look at it and go, oh,
it's true. Now, let's be honest, though. I mean, Brutrolium, moved your career, I'm sure, and it will help you again whenever you want in the future because it's it's insane. It's awesome. But like, how many times have you been asked though in a room to like, well, can you do something like Brutroleum? Like, is there anyone, does it ever come up like in a meeting of like, I just do Brutroleum? Cause I know I was talking with, you know, the person who did, like a girl, and she says, oh yeah, I'll get that every so often. Like, well, you know, it's always usually like an account exec who's like very, you know, just wants to get out of the room fast. You know, it's just like, just do something like a girl, you know, like something like that, hashtag, whatever. And they walk away. Like, has Brutroleum just like never come up once to like, you know, or just do that again, Simon?
It's like, honestly, it has never, ever come up. Good. It has never come up. You know, like the Droga stuff for Echo, you know, when Air Force One,
yep.
know, that was kind of, you hear David Droga talking about that, you know, every client wanted it because it was a viral film.
Right.
You know, and I think those ideas are kind of easier to ask for again because they go, they're really just asking for the result.
The result.
We paid no money and, you know, we got massive kind of.
Or even hidden camera vibe or something about the functionality or execution that you can replicate, I suppose. Yeah. Yeah. That's
but
funny.
It wasn't the creative department that made Brutroleum in the same way it wasn't the marketing department that made Brutroleum. You know, it was incredible marketers, but then also like the embrace of the whole business over there. So I think a lot of the times it's hard for a marketing department to really mobilize their whole business behind an idea. And I think that's probably one of the main reasons that marketers don't really ask us for a Brutroleum.
Fair enough. Well, let's put a bow on that then. Like, tell me who would some of the people, like, you know, Brutroleum doesn't get made without them, the people who really, like, you know, kicked ass on that for, you know, with you guys. Who are those people? And then we'll get into the actual, you know, the creative process in more of a general ethereal pirate kind of way.
The, you know, there was the creative team, Andre, Maddie, Brett, and myself, and then Andy Blood overseeing him and Nick Worthington. That was kind of the creative side, but and they were obviously fundamental to it. But you know, the account side, like Brody Reed, the account was run by Brody Reed, Brody McLeish now, and you know, she was just like a driving force and totally unflappable and, you know, matched our enthusiasm every day for it. And then same with Scotty Chapman, who was in production, who just somehow found a way. And it's almost chapterized those people. Brody was, you know, one of the first people we told. She was excited. Scotty was down in production. He was excited. Then once we made it, I think we rushed a case study to get into the One Show. And I don't think we'd finished everything and we hadn't got the results. And I don't think it won anything at the One Show. And it was just like, oh my God, this has all been not for nothing because we were selling a ton of beer. But, you know, I had hoped that we'd be rewarded for it with a trophy. But then we got an amazing editor, Mike Hammond, in to build our case study. And he just threw himself at it and made a killer story. So they were three kind of different chapters of the process that those guys are fundamental to. And then the whole DB crew, Maud and Sean and Tony, they were just, amazing.
All right. So we're changing gears a little bit. I'm going to do this again. So, all right. you're giving me excuses here. So, you know,
that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about sort of being a creative. And then also, too, let's talk about CAN. Like, because actually being there and doing all that and what it's all about, that's fun. So what was it like, you know, winning at CAN with Brutroleum? You were there or what? How did it all go down? What happened?
Yeah, I wasn't there, which
a lot of people aren't there when they win. Yeah. I know this is something coming up that's coming up on this podcast a lot, which it didn't happen to me. I got pulled out of a shoot and said get on a plane. So you know, Tor Mirren just you know basically called us and said get on a plane, you're coming here, and that's it. So this happens a lot. And tell me why and what happened.
Well, I think I had the option. Like, I think I had the option of going to Cannes and knowing whether we'd win or not. But the year had been a year from presenting to making it, and it had been a mad time, and I hadn't seen a lot of my awesome little family, and so I knew Cannes was coming, so we booked a family holiday to Fiji, and we went to Fiji, and then there's a little bit of a time difference in Fiji, and so basically Andre, who was my creative partner by that stage, you know, I'd turn my phone off at night and in the morning I'd wake up and I'd turn it on and it would try and find a signal, it would just blow up and
you
it was just
disappeared. You know,
it was
good.
Oh, it was just, it was the best way to do it. Cause you know, like it had been taxing on my wife and kids to make it. And so to celebrate it with them was really cool. And the, an amazing, creative guy who is a good buddy of mine, he told me, you know, because ad awards kind of lose a bit of value, you know, I guess because there's so many shows. But he was talking about he was super stoned. This is a bit of a wayward kind of story, but he's super stoned with a friend of his on an island, and they were walking along and he found this rock and it was this perfectly spherical kind of rock. And he was kind of buzzing out at this rock and they went up to this lookout and the lookout said, you know, if you have a stone, throw it. And he was like, oh man, I don't want to throw this stone.
Right, I found the perfect stone.
And he threw it and it made this ginormous kind of splash and you know, but instantly he was gutted that he had lost this stone and he turned to his other stone mate and he was like, oh man, I threw away the best stone in the world. And he and his mate turned to him and said, yeah, but it made a pretty good splash. And you know, like that was his way of telling me, you know, like just enjoy the moment. It's not about the trophy. It's not about the trophy. It's about the moment. And you know, that trophy is pretty dusty on a shelf at the moment, but that moment, like I'll never forget it. And you know, I hired a jet ski at Fiji and just went full Kenny Powers and just and Colenso were amazing. They'd sent the room champagne and you know, it was just such a cool moment. I'm so glad I just enjoyed it.
Same thing happened to me. Well, what happened to me though, I remember when I did it was like, I got pulled into like basically a whole group of room of gray people. And then they said, so you know what you won, right? I'm like, no. And so I had no idea. And that's when sort of Tor and Per Pedersen told me what had happened. And everyone just kind of stared at me. And I think I'd been a can guy for a long time. And of course I knew what titanium was, but I didn't realize what it was. And I think it's the relief of the work, of the time that you put into it. Exactly. And the time that takes on your family, you know, from doing all this stuff and cranking it out. And I think also for me, I know there was an emotional toll on it because we were dealing with guns and, you know, violence here. So there was an emotional part of it too, that was just kind of like, oh, I'm so glad this, you know, turned into, it was good. I was happy with the work, obviously, but at the end of the day, to have that finish and be done, there is this relief of, oh, it's over. And I think I don't know about you, but like, obviously we put a lot of, you know, too much value on awards. I think that's passing a bit, which is good. And so our job is often to win them. You know, when you do win the big one, there is a relief like, oh, okay, I did do it. But, you know, I don't know. There's that, I think, too, for me. I don't know. Did you feel that at all?
I felt, yeah, I 100% agree with you. The that feeling of relief, but also validation, you know, the what we do, you know, there aren't really clear right answers. So, you know, when you do, you know, when a piece of work gets acknowledged by the industry peers as, you know, being good, that is, you know, that's the validation that it's hard to come by in this industry. And you never engineer work to win awards, but you know, when it does, it is validation.
You never make it to make an award at the end of the day. You just make the work and then hopefully it does, you know, at the end of the day. But then it's sort of like, if the problem is though, is if you don't win any, you know, you don't get to be the CCO.
Yeah, that's right. It is a currency, isn't it? And the what I like though is that I feel like Effies are becoming more and more of a currency. Yeah, I think before it was the Clios and the but now, you know, there is that metric. I think the metric for greatness is now, you know, creatively brilliant, business results brilliant, the client relationship brilliant. Those three coming together are more, I think, the metric that good agencies are basing their success on.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, Cannes is still the Olympics. You know, so if you can win the most effective, the effectiveness lion at Cannes, for me, that's kind of one of the top ones, if not obviously the Effies, though, being the results. The problem with the Effies are funny, though, because like sometimes, I mean, the results at the end of the day, as we all know, can be just effective. It can be so many things. There could be no media weight. Yeah. There could be, you know, it could be that something with distribution screwed up at the client, so they didn't make the sales. It could be, there's just so many things that can go wrong. So maybe, you know what, maybe that's even, maybe because all those things didn't go wrong, that maybe that's why it is more important to win the you know, the Effie, because all those little pieces that could fail didn't, right? Or less of them did in comparison to everybody else.
I mean, there are so many other factors, aren't there, that dictate your success. You know, being delisted from Walmart, you know, just as you go live, and you know, those types of things.
Yep.
You know, that is the kind of the ad gods that we work to, you know, like who knows what they'll throw at you. So and that's another thing that when I talk to juniors, I'm like, luck has so much to do with it. Luck and timing has so much to do with it.
Yeah.
And the you know, we got lucky on Brutroleum that, you know, that we had the right people and you know, the right partners came on board. But so often, you know, it doesn't happen, but you just box on, you know.
That's good. Now, have you been to Cannes since, or?
Yeah, I was. I think we went the following year. So I've judged a couple of times, which has been great. And the
that sounds like you're not really at Cannes though when you do that. Cause, I mean, you're just in a room. Well, you're busy, right?
Both times I was on radio juries, and juries. If anyone else is listening, who are thinking about judging at Cannes, get on the radio jury. It's beanbags and sunshine, and you know, just listening to great ads.
So
as opposed to film jury, which is, you know, you're in the south of France, but you're in a bunker for kind of 12 days.
That's good. I love radio. I still remember one of my favorite ads of all time was a radio ad where I remember when I was going through the going on canlines.com, and I'm going through to see what. And then when I got to the radio category, I think it was like the second year or something like that when radio was there, and someone had a video and everyone else had MP3s, right? And the Grand Prix had a video, and I was like, well, it's the audacity of these guys. Who are these guys, right? And it was for like an outsider magazine. It was Brazil, if I remember correctly. And they had gone and put a tone on the radio that warded off mosquitoes. The tone was brought to you by Outsider Magazine or whatever it was. And I was like, I've never seen that before. And it was just still to this day, I'm like, you know, everyone thinks, of course, radio has been done 1,000 times, and these guys just went and did something you'd never seen before. And I was like, oh, so good.
Yeah, it was a really unloved category that, you know, when you disrupted or the medium, or if you changed how you did radio, you really, those ideas could definitely kind of stand above the other ones pretty easily.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed judging. I really enjoyed Cannes. I think I was there the following year after Brutroleum. And what was great about Brutroleum was that the account, Chris, I was in Fiji, but then, you know, it started winning, and our clients, Maud and Sean, were up there having a great time. And then they basically called Colenso and said, you get up here, guys. And they got the Brody and Ange Watson up there.
Good.
And so the account crew just, you know, were there. And, you know, that was really important for Andre and I, and for Maddie and Brett. Just, they deserved it. And it was and seldom, you know, it's so skewed in agencies, you know, when all the glory goes to the creators, when, you know, that isn't a reflection of the effort that went into making it.
Yeah, exactly. I try and go every year just because it gives me energy again. You know, it's like, it's just this, okay, it's just for 1 week of just refreshing and reminding myself why I came into this industry. You know, it's like just to see the great work, talk to the people who made it, have conversations like this, you know. Sure, you're having a rosé here and there, but then, you know, then we'll add on a vacation to it. So you're already there anyway. So go to Barcelona or go to, you know, pop up to Italy or something like that. So,
I think it's like, I don't know if this is, this relates to you or not, but I think it's okay to be really pumped up on ads. Like I really love advertising, and maybe that makes me a total loser, but I think that's how you get good at something as well. Like you're 100% dedicated to it. And you know, you see the work out of Crispin and Droger, and you feel the dedication that those people put into it. And I think that comes from being really passionate and about it. So yeah, same with me, you know, it's a shot in the arm of enthusiasm and seeing the best work and and leaving, going, I gotta make that.
Well, then let's dive into that. Like, how did you become an advertising guy? Like, what was the impetus to say, you know what, this is what I want to do for a living? Like, what, you know, were you in high school? Was it college? What was the sort of the I want to make ads moment?
I'm not really sure. The failure was probably what got me into advertising, which is really interesting. Like, I tried to get into journalism.
You know school. How many of your ideas have died, right? So there you go. You picked the right industry.
Yeah, you got to be okay with failure. Yeah. But I applied for broadcast journalism school. I wanted to get be a broadcast journalist. And I think there were about 20 people that were allowed into the course. I got down to the final kind of 30 or whatever. And they interviewed me and it was a total car crash. This panel of academics, you know, one of them asked me why I wanted to be a broadcast journalist. And I said, I wanted a job without monogamy instead of monotony. And so, you know, that was the first cross. And then they asked me what broadcast journalist I really admired. And I said, Jim Hickey, who was a weather guy, who was a weather presenter.
Absolutely.
And, he took such inane information like pressure systems and made it really interesting. And I really admired that. But that was a disaster. And then they gave me a spelling test and I failed. And then I went off for a couple of years and snowboarded, almost made my way to Stratton.
Ooh. Yeah. You were saying Colorado too. You were hanging around.
Yeah. So I lived for a couple of years in Winter Park in Colorado and taught snowboarding and then came back and started ad school effectively and with a communication school with a major in TV, radio and then in the end I applied for TV, applied for radio and got into advertising.
Yeah, that's great. I started in radio. I love radio. I think as a writer, I mean, you don't have to worry about budget. You can just write whatever you want. You know, it's like, it was always just fun. You know, you can just make stuff. I was always like a Bugs Bunny, Mel Blanc, you know, kind of guy at the end of the day. So I love just like different voices. And, you know, I was an only child, so I would make up my own little stories with different voices. My mother would come up and thinking there's different kids in the room, you know, like I invited somebody over that she didn't know. And no, it's just my son sitting there being weird again. So, yeah.
It's also, I think, one of the purest forms of putting an idea out into the world. You know, you don't have the special effects or the celebrity kind of. I don't know. It is just idea first.
Yeah, it's so funny too because it's so easy to make a good one. I think. Well, I mean, you have to know your stuff. You have to like go back and listen to the, you know, the Stan Freebergs of the world and, you know, all the guys who were making radio great back in the day. You know, it's like Terry O'Reilly out of Canada made fantastic advertising with like Taxi, you know, and so you would hear just these great radio ads all the time back in Canada. So I just fell in love with the medium. But then, yeah, advertising after that. So like, what was your I saw that your first job was you were interning at Saatchi & Saatchi. Was that, where was that?
Well, yeah, that was, so we started out at this very small agency interning at this kind of pamphlet place, my partner and I, James Tucker and I, and then all we did was play table tennis. We got fired after kind of 8 months. And then we interned at JWT, which was like, we knew nothing about the industry, but we definitely knew that this was not a good agency to be in already. And so in our lunch breaks, we would sneak down to Saatchi's, which is down the road, and we'd take briefs from the senior teams. And,
oh, nice.
And so we were kind of doing two at one time. And then the Saatchi CEO, Toby Talbot, moved to DDB. And when he moved, he said, come over here and be intern. So that's really where we started, DDB under Toby.
And that was in New Zealand, right? In Auckland area?
That was in New Zealand, and we spent 4 years there, and we managed to get some work that kind of got some profile in New Zealand and globally, and DDB was an amazing place to do TV, radio, and out of home, and then the Colenso, they were just pumping out just mad ideas, and we felt like we kind of honed the craft of making advertising, and we just wanted to do something else, and so we got into Colenso.
It's cool. Do you find now that like you have like a creative process for yourself locked down, or is it still kind of nebulous, or like, you know, or at least, you know, I know that sometimes when you write, people write a book, they say, of course, like you just have to sit down and write every day. Like that's their process. Just making sure you're sitting in front of it and just getting your reps in. Like, do you have a process now, do you think, for being creative?
I think the more information you have, like the better your work is going to be. The more you know, I think the better your work is going to be. So the, you know, finding great strategists. I love planners. You know,
me too.
And so, you know, finding a great planner who really knows the business and really knows the category is a really important starting point. And also stress testing the brief right from the get go. Like, can you come up with three ideas really kind of quickly? You know, does this feel like it's not over intellectualized? It's got some simplicity to it. So that is kind of the first part of that process, which is pretty painful sometimes as a creative person, you know, like, and to do the due diligence on something when you just want to get in there and start writing.
Right.
But I find it's really important.
I'm the same way. I'm a huge, like, I should probably be a planner at the end of the day, because I love it so much and I love strategy. My only question, okay, so here in the US and in Canada, every planner and strategist is from London. And of course they have more of an accent like yourself. They come in, they say, there are brilliant ones, don't get me wrong, but a lot of the time they'll use the accent to their advantage and they'll say wonderful things, brilliant. You know, but is it sometimes, what accent is used in New Zealand? Is it just, do you have Brits too? Or is it straight? Like, you know, there's this American like accents. I'm like, well, that guy's smart. Where's he from? Kentucky? Ooh, like what's, because the strategist can say anything and they get away with it.
I 100% agree. I think that is the core to being a brilliant strategist. And I work with a lot of brilliant ones at Adam and Eve, DDB in London, you know, and maybe it was just the accent that, and also the way they sit, how they cross their legs. I feel that's important. I think you can pretty quickly figure out, in a room who's just saying stuff and who is moving an idea forward. And I'm really wary of meetings and good points in meetings. Like, nobody sees meetings, you know, and that's something that is, we talk about a lot at Cleanso, like good meetings don't matter. It's the work that matters. It's the only thing that matters. So I think you need to be really aware of just kind of good conversations, but bad work. You know, you always need to keep an eye on the output, because that's the only thing that people see. They only see a TV ad. They don't see a keynote, you know, 54 page deck. You know, they just see the work. So, I think just being aware of that and not losing sight of it.
And also encourage creatives who want to be great, I think, to also like see what it's like to be a strategist, you know, like try it out, even like learn the process. Cause I sat down with Colin Drummond, who was the head of strategy for Crispin back in the day. Right. This was around 2008 or something like that. And he was Canadian. I was Canadian. You know, we were both in there, and I sat down with him and I said, hey, you know, give me some books. Tell me about, you know, this stuff. And so he gave me a bunch of stuff and we chatted about strategy, and he was just so like, he was so good. And I still remember asking him, like, so like who, you know, outside of yourself, man, like who's the best strategist in this place? And he looks at me and he goes, oh, Alex Boguski.
Yeah.
It's like that, like there's no one in my department that's better than Alex. So, like he's better than me. So like, you know, to be a creative, you also need to be a strategist. And as you say, like just know this stuff cold and be able to screw with it, you know, be comfortable enough with it and know it so that you can kind of almost screw with it and mess with it and turn it upside down.
Yeah. I think you look at the Crispin work and you look at White and Kennedy stuff and the executions are so bonkers, but the intelligence at the heart of it is so, so clear. And I think that gives them permission to do just mad stuff, because strategically it's so sound. And there are those rare kind of creatives. Nick Worthington's one of them, and Levi Slavin, our CCO at the moment, is one of them, who are just really strategically kind of aware. It's so helpful in the process to have them involved.
That's good. So now you've dove into your research, you're hardcore into the strategy, you know, down to like click through rates on some website, even for all I know, but like, okay, so now you got to make some shit. What, like, do you, I'll give you an example. Like, I know, some people, I've heard a lot that a lot of people have to go analog, especially writers, and they need to write. you know, whereas like physically with their hand, right, just to get the body moving or whatever. And some people just like to sit down and type, you know, another person likes just to highlight stuff in that deck, you know, and then just start riffing on words. Like, do you have any sort of just sort of, you know, how do you get out of the starting blocks as a writer, do you think?
Yeah, the writers who type on their computers freak me out. I don't understand how they do that, especially the writers who go to Starbucks, like a crowded cafe, and punch into their computers. I just don't understand it. So the I'm all about, you know, like a pencil and a pad and sitting somewhere really quiet, in my car if I have to, and just on my own. When Andre and I worked together, it was and Brady and James, but we would always talk about the brief first, and then we would disappear individually.
Yeah.
And then come back, and at least for a day or two, and then come back and compare notes, and you go, what about this? Oh, that could be cool. So there, I find it hard to just start ideating straight away together. Kind of, I need to figure stuff out on my own first, and then come back together.
I think people really have to figure that out. And if anyone's, say someone, if the person who's listening right now, like, has just come into this podcast, you need to go back and listen to the other ones too, because there's definitely a delineation between, like, I think you're one person or the other. Like, you need to like go off on your own and start doing it, or you need to, you know, just sort of go right into the group and sort of like, you know, writer room style at SNL, where you're just spitballing and throwing shit against the wall. Because I don't think there's a middle ground. You know, like, I'm more like you. I'm the same way. I got to go away for a little bit. Whereas my friend Joel, you know, like, he loves the writer's room, and he loves just, you know, he likes feeling the energy from when people get excited, or watching the faces of the eyebrows as you're throwing nuggets out there. So, but I'm just not, I don't know. It's just something about like not being able to maybe digest it all while you're in the room, or maybe it seems too chaotic. I just don't like that to be the starting point. It's great, you know, once you've all got ideas and you start messing around, and you can end up down a rabbit hole. But yeah, like knowing which person you are and what you feel good with is good to lock into.
Yeah, and there's no right way or wrong way. It's just whatever works for you. And I find a room just a bit overwhelming, like when you're just getting your head around something. Mm-hmm. But it can be beneficial later on in the process.
Do you notice like ideas strike at like random times for you? Have you got a sweet spot during the day or the week, or any, or maybe snowboarding, you know, crushing some hills, and all of a sudden the ideas start happening? What's your, do you see me? Anything?
Yeah, I'm all in on mornings. Like, morning is the most prolific kind of thinking time for me. So I'll get up really early and just be alone and think, and also make peace with the fact that in the afternoon I'll be hopeless, you know, and not kill myself. You know,
to failure, right? You know your failure already, so you're going to be fine. Yeah.
But also make peace with the fact that I could get up at 4 and work until 7 and have nothing and be okay with that. You know, that's part of the creative process. You got to have belief that it will come. Otherwise, you know, you'll just unravel yourself. Like, believing in yourself is just so important in your abilities as a creative. So, yeah, the morning the morning is definitely my sweet spot. And yeah, in the afternoon, when people put creative reviews in for the afternoon, I'm just like, this is going to be a disaster.
Yeah, for sure. Do you listen to like music at all, or do you have any kind of, or do you just like the quiet with a coffee nice and early?
Yeah, silence. It's all silence for me. And just no music. Sometimes headphones on, but without any music on. But no distractions. It's weird. Like, if I work in a public space, somehow I turn into get these spidey senses, and I hear someone talking about how her cousin, you know, is breaking up with her husband. And I'm like, what? What's happening? What's the backstory? I want to know more. And instantly, you know, I'm lost. Yeah, go on. So yeah, I just need like no other stimulus, really.
That's funny. Yeah, I find that it's funny with create. Like, it's funny too when you said, like, you know, when you're buzzing and you guys were excited in the room when all of a sudden Beer Trolium came up, right, originally. And like, do you ever notice, like, I notice this when I'm alone. I've said this on a few other podcasts. I get this weird little fuzzy feeling. It's almost like sort of like almost like I just put a little hood on, like a helmet. Like, things get quieter, they get softer, they get more, I don't know, tunnel visioned almost when I'm writing the thing. And then you can't write fast enough. It's like, but you're just super stoked and buzzed about some idea that you just see the fruit falling from the trees. Do you get any kind of like actual physical reaction from a good idea?
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. You know, like when you strike something, yeah, some people walk away from it, you know, satisfied that, yeah, that's it, we got it. But yeah, I am like, oh, this is, you know, this is the moment. Let's quickly get it down before, you know, the brilliance kind of disappears for like 3 days. Mm-hmm. So and I remember Andre and I were working on the child replacement program the brief for Pedigree. And we were just talking about, you know, how do we get these dogs adopted and blah, blah. And then eventually we got to this child replacement program and yeah, it was like electric. Now let's write everything down that we're thinking about because it feels like things are flying. And I get quite anxious if I don't have the ability to quickly make the most of that moment if I've got to go off. Yeah, that for me, that moment is really important.
One thing that we did at Gray, which I still think is genius. Well, Tor demanded it, which was a good idea. People don't know who Tor is. Tor Mieren is now runs advertising and marketing for Apple. He used to be the Gray CEO or CCO for a long time. But his idea was maybe he knew too that like mornings were more prolific for people. So I think I'm the same way. It's like early morning before noon, you know. And we made sure that there were no meetings on Thursdays. No meeting Thursdays, mornings. That's it. Like you can't, unless of course there's, you know, maybe you're knee deep in something and you know, maybe you got a good project on the go and you got to keep the momentum going or one meeting will help a ball move down like that. That's fine. Or say there's obviously a client emergency and they're on the phone yelling at you. You got to be there. But just for setting that some time aside where no one can put a meeting on your calendar. That was like something that really stuck with me. I think we got some of our best work done in that little pocket, you know, because there were no distractions and there was kind of a focus to focus. So is there anything that like you've done or you've seen somewhere else that you think like sort of infuses the creative mind or the process of any agencies you've been at?
I think the belief from your creative leaders that you will get an answer and however, whatever methodology you use to get that answer, you know, I support you and back you, I think is an important thing to have in an agency. So the, and juniors and middleweights and, you know, people in agencies who feel like maybe they can't dictate the terms should feel like they can dictate the terms because the reason you're there is to come up with great work, you know? And right. So whatever methodology you choose, you should feel like you have the right to kind of work that way because all we need is brilliant ideas and so do whatever it takes to get them. But the I think the agencies who do the best work are open to the idea that you know people work in different ways
and confidence, as you say, like having confidence from the leadership, big thing, but also I think confidence in yourself, which also can be like, I mean, let's be honest. I've seen it happen where there's some people who like, you know, like they won something big and then their creative spirit, how shall we say, got a little too big, you know? It's like, no, I'm telling you, man, I'm a, you know, I'm a can winning lion guy. Like I'm a diaper on a monkey. This is gold. This is going to win. You know, like, do you find like now that you've won, you know, a titanium and you got all this stuff on, you know, these awards under your belt, has your superpowers gotten stronger or have they gotten just like, have they gone off the rails? Like what do you think has happened?
I don't know. I hope they wouldn't go off the rails, but I think the, I don't know. The belief is so important. Like, and I feel like
if you're trying to force Voltron, like you had Voltron when you made Brutorium, yeah. Right? Like if you try and force Voltron because you know what you're doing or you say you are, like do people just hate you?
I think the best when you get to the best work is because you is through terror. You know, I'm not going to come up with anything. And I think that's cool. I kind of vibe on that, you know, the
ride the
petroleum
lightning.
Petroleum was an answer. And then you get another brief to sell, you know, potato chips and you're like, oh my God, I'm not going to come up with anything. And, you know, I think that insecurity is an amazing fuel and propellant. And I reckon actually it's really dangerous when awards start kind of stifling your ambition. I reckon that whenever I'm at Cannes, maybe it's just I'm a sicko, but especially if I don't win, I'm like, oh man. Or if I do win, I'll go, how am I going to do that next year? Mm-hmm. And ambition, I think, is some people are really satisfied with winning something, and that's cool. But yeah, I as we were talking before about, you know, ads age really quickly and you're only as good as your last stuff. And I think you just want to keep, going. Well, I just want to keep going.
Yeah. I just want to keep cranking. That's why I love Can too, going, you know, and being, seeing the work and being a part of it. It's like seeing someone crack something, especially the titanium, where it's just like, you can do that. I don't know. You could do that. And like, it's like you're sort of pointing at something and they changed the, you know, they changed something that you hadn't seen, like that radio ad that won the Grand Prix. I just love seeing that kind of stuff. And just, you know, it's funny. And also too, when you talk about fear, right? So like, fear can be, I think, a huge killer to creativity. Like, as you said, you walked around the agency with, you know, with your idea. You were walking around the agency and everyone was super excited and buzzing and feeling good about it. But then in other agencies, they'd say you can't do it. Like, do you find that, like, it's good to have the fear to come that you're not going to ever come up with another idea again, which then forces you to come up with an idea. But do you find fear internally to be like a big creative killer? That's the way I kind of think about it, I guess. But I don't know if, like, if you see that too, I guess. Hopefully I'm articulating that correctly. But just, you know, it's this internal fear of like, that's never been done before. People kind of shy away from it.
Yeah, I think it's probably a reflection of the agencies that I've been in, the Adam and Eve's and the Colenso's and the DDB, that, yeah, I don't feel like there was that fear there. There was almost a fear of doing ordinary work, so, you know. But in the same breath, I can completely understand that fear exists in other agencies, and that definitely makes making great work harder. I think the biggest chokehold on creativity is a lack of self-belief, you know, because we don't have right answers. It's not black and white. We're not accountants, mm-hmm. you know, so when you don't believe in your abilities and you don't believe with conviction about ideas, yeah, I think that's when you can really unravel as a creative.
And hence why we chase awards. I wonder if that'll go away, you know, because as you're saying, like you do feel the, oh, okay, no, I'm not crazy in this subjective world. Like, my peers said I'm okay, you know, like, because that's our challenge every single day on every single brand all the time, you know. It's I think there needs to be less award shows because, I mean, it makes your head spin, you know. Like, I get the local regional ones, but then we start doing like 50 different shows, you're like, okay, enough already. But
awards should mean something, you know. Like, if you're winning 700 awards a year, you know, it loses meaning.
It's like MLB baseball. They have 160 games. You're like, come on, you know.
The industry just doesn't need that many shows. No. But I think the buzz, like, if you're looking for validation, award shows are one way of getting validation as a creative. But then also the buzz you get from, you know, your dad sending you your idea and he doesn't know it's your idea, or the buzz that, you know, someone just throws it up on Facebook who you don't know and that just goes, have you seen this amazing thing? You know, that's a massive part of validation and obviously the results that business results that come with it. But yeah, but Can is still an important one because it's the currency that us creatives use, you know.
Yeah, my favorite award of all time was I was sitting on my porch. I was in my 20s. I was working in radio at the time, and some girl came up who was meeting my roommate, and she was laughing. I just came out of her car and she's laughing. She goes, oh, I was just thinking about you. I'm like, why? Ah, there was this radio ad on. It made me laugh. Oh my God. And I was like, well, what was it for? And it was for Blockbuster. Right. And sure enough, I had written it, you know, so to get it from not from anyone from the business, not from an award show, none of that. It was just this rando person having a good emotional little laugh and just being like, that was something funny, that, you know, that was good. And it turned out to be something that you had done. I was like, I still remember that. And it's probably still one of my favorite things.
The exact opposite thing happened to me. The very first ad I ever made was a radio ad for Lynmore City Shopping Center. And my best mate's little brother came around to pick me up in his car to take me around to your house. And I hope he goes, I just heard the worst radio ad. And I was like, oh, what was it? Oh, it was for Lynmore City. And yeah, it was exactly your experience, but the opposite.
That's great. Did it go like this? And you just do it verbatim.
It was. He was right. It was horrific. Good. But that was an important lesson for me. Like, you know, boardroom interesting versus real world interesting. Yeah. You know, what we did when we sold that radio ad was we solved a problem in a boardroom and everyone got excited. And then you put it into the real world and people were like, what is this?
Exactly.
You know, like, and so you lose perspective in those rooms of the importance of your brand and the importance of your message. So, yeah, that failure was a really important lesson, just to make sure you audit your ideas by, you know, thinking about how they turn up in the real world and whether anyone will care about them.
Well, let's go with your fail. Let's put a bow on this sucker and talk about then not the worst ad that your friend had ever heard, but your favorite ads from Cannes. It doesn't have to be from Cannes either. I always just pick Cannes because it's like got most of the global stuff that you can always, you know, pick from. But like, what are the three ones that, you know, get you out of bed in the morning to go beat, so to speak, because they make you so jealous?
The opt-out side, you know, seeing, you know, it was obviously 2016, the same year that Brutrolium was winning. And, you know, I just loved that idea just so much. It was such an authentic idea. It wasn't just marketing, you know, it was a brand being true to the reason it existed, you know, in the most audacious and terrifying way, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I watched it, Canada, for the first time, man, I was just so happy for everyone involved. It was such a... It seemed so hard, and they did it, and they nailed it, and you know, it made REI a heap of money. But yeah, and listening, was it Lee Einhorn who had mm-hmm. done that?
Yep. Yeah, oh yeah.
Listening to that backstory, you know, I was just, man, I was smiling the whole time. I just, it's so audacious, but it's so right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it.
Well, that's actually where I met Lee, which was funny because a friend of mine, his name's Adam Elk. He said, "Hey man, we're gonna roll up to up to these guys' place and hang out for the morning." And it was like the Sunday before the whole thing began, so about four of us are just sitting by the pool, you know, hanging around, drinking beers for hours, pretty much just day drinking. We just didn't want to start the festival because we knew what the week was going to be, you know. So we just didn't want to be around anybody. We just hung around and talked music. Right. And I had won the years prior, 2 years before that. So we were talking about that. And then what was it like? And what did you do? And then I remember I was sort of sitting there and I was like, "Which one did you do?" And he was like, "Oh, we did something called opt outside." I'm like, "Well, you're going to find out real soon what it's like." I was like, "Holy Jesus." So we, you know, I was loving on him and we've been friends ever since. And of course, with all the guys over there at Venables, we're awesome. So, yeah, I mean, that was a good one. That's a pretty good one that you had there. What about like two and three? What are your other favorites?
Yeah, this was hard, but the man your man could smell like for Old Spice. Like I kind of don't want to say that because I want to be more original than that, but that totally changed that just changed the way that I worked, you know, to see that how insanely clever the thinking was, but how bonkers the execution was, you know. Like, and I think before I'd seen that, I was trying to write funny work, but mm-hmm. when I saw that, I go, be smart first,
right,
and then write funny, because you know, you'll never look like this guy, but you could smell like him. It's just the most amazing creative starting idea. I think that's just,
yeah, I think it started. I mean, the most interesting man in the world, I'm not sure exists if, you know, that ad doesn't come out first. It's got kind of the same kind of flavors too, but it's just this brilliant setup and it's perfect and it's right down to what it needs to be. There's psychology in it. And then of course it can just take off and go anywhere, you know?
And I think I was at Cannes that year. I was judging, and Old Spice was, and it was just everywhere. You know, it was the Old Spice show. The Palais was just kind of full of it. And the fact also that, you know, the brand was on its knees. Old Spice was, you know, all the people who wore Old Spice were dying effectively.
Yeah.
You know, and that came out and it just completely reversed the fortunes of the brand. I think it is just, you know, I really can't stand cynical people in this industry. I find they just suck the energy out of the room and just, mm-hmm. you know, and so when I see work like that, that works in the way that it does, you know, it is, it just gives me faith that, you know, what we're doing is properly adding value to products and businesses. Yeah, I just, winding Kennedy, I'm a bit of a fanboy.
Oh, everyone's a fanboy. Oh, yeah. Well, except when I came here to Vermont, I would say things to people. I've moved out of the city just for a bit, which worked out perfectly for COVID. But I'm just saying that when I bring up that stuff here and I start talking about advertising, you know, no one has any idea what Wieden Kennedy is and what Droga is and Crispin and all that stuff. And I'm just like, I'm looking at these guys and I'm like, man, like you need to deep dive into this stuff because it's just, you just have so much, it's just awe. And respect for, especially for a Wieden who has stayed that long, that, you know, independent that long and just still making the best work in the world, You know, it's just, it's wonderful.
It is. It's unreal. You know, that every agency goes hot and cold, and they have just stayed on, you know. And
yep.
Yeah.
So good. All right, number three.
Number three was a toss-up between Epic Splits and Gatorade Replay, but I went with Gatorade Replay. Mm. You know, just the first time that I'd seen advertising do branded entertainment like properly, like you know that they sold out a stadium, that they basically got people watching a 90-minute ad or however long the game was. You know, and it was such a human story. I wanted to watch it. You know, these old guys who used to be, well, not old guys, but they've been out of college for that long. Could they get back? It was just magic, and also the product role in it. You know, like you see a lot of branded entertainment now that's a tenuous kind of link to the brand or the reason the brand's in the world. But, you know, Gatorade Replay was just at the heart of it was the product. And
yeah,
I think there was TBWA LA, but I remember instantly, you know, like looking at their website, are they hiring people from New Zealand? You know, just can I get a visa? It was amazing.
That's good. Those are some great pieces. And I mean, you know what? Someone's going to be saying that about Brutroleum at some point, you know, I mean, down the road, as they're like, man, when I was in ad school, man, the Brutroleum came out, it changed my world. So, you know, you're a part of that legacy of all the ones that you love, that someone else loves yours too. So congratulations on that.
Thank you,
bud. All right. So let's just, put a bow on it, man. Thank you for hanging out. This was so much fun. And you know, I mean, New Zealand is New Zealand, so we'll see each other in Canada some point. Yeah,
definitely. Thank you, Jordan.
Special thanks to the musical nerds over at Storefront Music in New York City for helping me with the tracks and some of the sound design here. Also, big thanks to my good friend Alan Peck out of Dallas, Texas.
You're welcome, and I love you.
Alan's been the promo voice of the Ellen DeGeneres Show for a long time now, and he's on a ton of other TV shows, and I think he's done about 1,000 commercials. Finally, a big shout out to all the people I've worked with over the years, both from the greatest advertising agencies on the planet to the now defunct radio station in small town Canada that I worked at back in 1997. Each and every one of you taught me something along the way that has led to this.